My friend Willard Barber, the state, the foreign service, called upon me to put a question to the speaker. The speaker done it. What we all thought was a very fine job. He presented well, but he had this habit of awing and awing. And my friend Barber sat there and counted the number of times that he had said aw in the course of 4 minutes. And instead of getting up and saying in a rather nice, polite way that as a preface to his question, that the speaker had been quite impressive, but he would like to question him and criticize him on one or two things, and it was really more of a critique. Yeah, I'm sorry, it was a critique one had to give rather than a question. You had to get up and give a critique, and where he could have been fairly complimentary, he'd missed doing that, and that's generally a useful part of a critique. If you're going to criticize somebody, you should pick out a few of the good points before you get on to some of the failings. But he got on to this matter of the humming and hawing, and the awing. And he said, "Now, your presentation was rendered ineffective by virtue of your verbal present punctuation. And I must inform you that you said ah 28 times in the space of 4 minutes. And it just ruined what you were trying to put over. And you must concentrate on getting over this." Well, one of the speakers yet to come was Willard Barber. When he got on the platform to speak, he also had this habit. People that have that habit are often quite unaware of the fact that they have it. Mm-hmm. And the professor was smart enough to call upon this previous speaker to criticize Barber, same one that Barber had criticized. So he just sat there himself and counted the number of awes. And when he got up to speak, he did it very nicely, and he complimented where compliment was justified, and he criticized where criticism was justified, but he wound up by saying, "But I'm afraid I must make one final comment, and that is that the presentation was really spoiled to a degree by the speaker's terrible habit of saying aw. And because he sat and counted the number of times I did, I sat and counted the number of times he said aw. And I have to inform him that he broke my record." And that his total was 36. Well, you know, I was watching Barbara. I was in a position where I could see his face. And it was a look of absolute disbelief. He wouldn't believe it at all. And when we drove home that night, he and I were our car. On days like this, we had to take two cars because the other members of carpool had to get home at the normal time. And so I was driving that night, the second car. And Barbara and I were the only two in it. We no sooner got underway, and he said, "I want you to tell me honestly, it was that fellow just pulling my leg." He said, "I don't say aw, do I?" I said, "Willard, I'm afraid I have to be truthful with you. You really were worse than he was." And I said, "When you get up to ask a question in the floor of the auditorium and after a lecture, when you're a little bit more nervous than perhaps you were in a smaller audience, you even use aw more frequently." He said, "Well, I didn't know that I ever had this failing." And he said, "When I come down here next week to give my next 4 minute talk, I am not going to say aw once." I said, "Now, Willard, that's an impossibility. You've developed this habit through the years. You can't expect to get it over." I said, "That's a laudable objective. You can't expect to overcome it in that period of time. He said, I'm going to come down here, and I'm not going to say it once. Well, you know, he's one of these very determined guys. And he had several children and a wife that kept him straight, too. And he said to each one of them, every time I use this verbal punctuation, you are to let me know. Doesn't matter whether it's breakfast, luncheon, breakfast, dinner, or any other time, social engagements or social contacts. If I'm talking to somebody else, interrupt me and tell me. And he concentrated for a whole week. And when he got down there the next week, he actually brought it from 36 down to 7, which was pretty good. It was remarkable. It really was. It was incredible. But the important thing was that when he got up to ask questions from the floor after that, he became so much more effective. He lost all of his impact by this verbal punctuation beforehand, before. And now he was able to get to say what he had to say without this hesitation. So it did him a great deal of good, and I guess it did all of us. It made all of us more conscious of this fact. I think most everybody from time to time has a little hesitation and uses it. An awe here and there. But it was useful. Well, I better wind up on this National War College. I said earlier that we had the privilege of attending there from 1947 to 1950 inclusive. There's another person living in this city who you may encounter in the course of your work on these interviews who had the benefit of that experience, and that was Admiral Hibbard. Oh, yes. I think he was on the third course in 1949. And he got a great deal out of it. Libby Hibbard is a great lover of people and makes friends easily. And not only did he enjoy the content of the course, but he thoroughly enjoyed meeting so many of these rather hand-picked people on the U.S. side and members of the State Department. And I think Jimmy found it very useful in his future career, traveling about in the Navy. You go a great deal of traveling there. I think he re-encountered many of his former associates, and he's maintained his contacts down there. He goes back and visits some of his friends. I haven't had an opportunity to do that very often. I had to go back there and speak once or twice, mm-hmm. but I haven't gone back there on a social basis. Once a year, there's a reunion down there, and I think Jimmy's managed to get to a few of those. The fellow George Anderson I spoke of earlier was a classmate of Jimmy's on this, mm-hmm. on his course, and they kept in close contact with one another. Well, unfortunately, the opportunity for Canada to send and Britain to send the students to that college has never been resumed. Here we are in 1981. The Americans do send 3 or 4 students a year to Imperial Defence College, London. And they have, right from the war years onwards, they do send students to the National Defence College in Kingston, and they have through the years, one from Army, one from Navy, and, for a while they were just sent 3, but they were chosen from Army, Navy, Air and State, but I think later it became one from each of them. And we've had some very fine chaps come up from the States to attend those courses. And we didn't have any reason or cause to discontinue this practice. And it was advantageous. It was to our advantage and to the British advantage. In the long run, we felt, to carry the practice on, because it would make it easier for them. and provide a reason for them to reinstate, but they've never got around to reinstating the practice. Whether it'll ever happen in the future, I don't know. The only thing I haven't talked about that I might have mentioned is that there were a number of brief field trips made while we're on the course. For example, we, as a course, the whole course went to visit the naval installations at Norfolk, Virginia, and while we were there, we had presentations there by senior naval personnel, and had an opportunity to see some of the naval craft, and actually we all went out on a naval carrier, one of the big FDR class, Coral Sea class. Mm-hmm. That was a great experience. Jack Slessor, the chief of the, I guess he just ceased to be the chief of the air staff, Royal Air Force, was with us on that occasion. He'd come to speak to the college, and his visit happened to coincide with our trip to Norfolk, so he took advantage of the opportunity going on that. He had a wonderful time on that trip. He had a gamey leg. He'd had an injury in World War I, and I think he had a wooden foot. And I can remember how fatigued he was at the end of the day, because we were up and down these ladders. And they don't call them ladders in the Navy, but... companionways or what have you. And I can remember how worn out he was at the end of the day, because that huge ships, you know. And although there are a certain number of elevators aboard, generally they're not convenient to use, and you're using your feet up and down all the time. He was a great fat chap, Jack Slessor. I got to know him later on, in later years, when I was commandant of the National Defense College at Kingston. He was one of our speakers who came there. I'll tell you an amusing story. I should reserve this for the National Defense College period, I guess, but we made a practice of inviting our speakers down to spend the night with us, come down the night before, and be rested for their presentation the next day, and afforded an opportunity to put on a dinner party for them, and to which we always invited several of the students and their wives, so they'd get an opportunity to meet informally. We'd have cocktails beforehand and dinner. And I was living at that time in a, I suppose you would describe it correctly, as a mansion. It was one of the big early Kingstonian houses that had been built for the Secretary of State when the government of Canada was located in Kingston back in the very early days, before the Dominion of Canada came into being. And the Slessors, and Lady Slessor is with him. They, after tea, they went up to get dressed for dinner. Everything was done rather formally in those days. You always dressed for dinner. And we had a cat, very famous cat, by the name of Hennessy. It was a big Siamese, and he was a Siamese tomcat, and he had a mind of his own. Somehow or other, he got into the, it was winter time, he got into the bedroom when the Slessors went up there to get dressed. And the radiators in that house were all encased, and there was sort of a boxed-in arrangement with a grill on top. And it was a nice place for a cat. He'd jump up there, and it was a nice warm spot. And all the time they were dressing, you know, Hennessy was on the top of the radiator. Well, when they came time to go down to dinner, Jack Slessor looked at the cat, and Englishmen, you know, don't like cats. Look at the cat, and he said, well, don't think I should leave him here when we go out. So, rather unceremoniously, he took his walking stick. He didn't carry the cane because of his bad foot. He pushed the cat off the radiator with his stick. Well, Hennessy wasn't used to be treated that way. And then he pushed him out the door with that wooden foot. That wasn't the treatment to which he was accustomed either. Took a dim view of it. Well, during the dinner, and the dining room doors were open out into the hallway, and there was one of those big circular winding staircases coming down from up above, very high ceiling abode. At one point, I felt a swish between my feet as I was sitting at the head of the table, and I thought, felt as though something had passed between. Moments later, at the far end of the table, because Schlesinger was seated on the right hand of my wife at the opposite of the table, Schlesinger jumped off his chair, and in the loudest voice said, "That damn cat bit me!" And you know, the cat had passed the wooden leg and had gone and taken a nip out of the good leg, and a fraction of a second later, I felt a swish through my legs, and the cat was on the way up the stairs again. And old Jack Schlesinger never allowed me to forget that. Every time we saw him after that, he would raise that. As a matter of fact, it was rather strange. That cat had a habit of biting Englishmen, or doing something nasty to Englishmen when they came in. And that cat was able to sense the fact that the Englishmen didn't like cats. And they, you know, they're dog lovers. Yeah. And that cat knew right off that he wasn't liked. And he would take full advantage of any opportunity that arose to retaliate.
He knew his leg was the real one.
Yeah. Well, it's I guess about time to break on that light note. I was still talking about the field trips. Yeah, there's one other field trip I should mention that was of interest. We made a trip off to Fort Knox. It provided an opportunity not only to see the way in which the gold reserves were stored, mm-hmm. but also there were some large military army installations there, and we were able to visit them. And of course, there was a big staff cottage there as well. So all in all, it was a useful place to visit. In typical American fashion, the day was absolutely filled with program. So much so that we were up at 5:30 in the morning to be able to work it all in. And I never forget that the ablution facilities were a little bit on the primitive side on this army base. And the shower heads were sort of open and exposed. There weren't any curtains or anything like that. And I never forget my surprise going into that shower room about 5:30 in the morning and seeing one of these American colonels standing with a cigar in his mouth, dodging the spray and maneuvering around to keep all the time smoking a big cigar. That was a sight I'll never forget. He was one of the colonels, army colonels on the course. So we had our lighter moments. Everyone got a great laugh out of that. From that little episode in the showers, we about 7:30 in the morning or 7 found ourselves out on the parade square watching a march pass by a division of troops. Really, it's a pretty impressive sight. When one up to that time had never been exposed to more than a squadron or certainly nothing bigger than a regiment. Very often not as big. Well, and I guess one other field trip we made was up to the United Nations and things like that. Those are fairly limited field excursions as things go in colleges of that nature. Imperial Defense College and the National Defense College both had very expensive field trips, which lasted, one or two months in a stretch, where you visited a whole variety of foreign nations and had an opportunity to meet with political and military and industrial leaders and and see how other countries function, what their problems are, and so on. It's not too often that the Americans do things modestly, but in the matter of field trips, they were much more modest than Britain and Canada. I think they lost something by that. There's a great deal to be learned and gained by intimate exposure to the political and economic and industrial financial life of other countries. Mm-hmm. And with that, let's call it quits for the day.
Okay, really good.